This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1. The Robots of Dawn by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1983 by Nightfall, Incorporated. Narrated by Bob Askey. This book contains 419 pages on 10 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. Annotation. Earth Detective Elijah Bailey is summoned to the planet Aurora, where he must solve the puzzling murder of an advanced human-like robot. He becomes painfully aware that man's future role in space depends upon the outcome of his investigation. Sequel to The Naked Sun, RD 17298. Some Descriptions of Sex. Bestseller, 1983. From the book jacket. A puzzling case of roboticide takes interplanetary detective Elijah Bailey from Earth to the planet Aurora, the self-styled World of the Dawn, where humans and robots coexist in seemingly perfect harmony. There, the most advanced robot in the universe, an awesomely human machine, has been murdered. Only one man on Aurora had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to commit the crime, and he has hired Bailey to prove he didn't do it. And to make Bailey's impossible mission even worse, he soon learns that not only his career, but the fate of the Earth as well, is riding on his investigation. For the murder of the humaniform robot is closely tied to a power struggle that will decide the ultimate question: who will be the next pioneers to colonize the universe, man or his machines? And the answer to that question could spell either doom or new hope for an overcrowded Earth. Armed only with his own instincts, his sometimes quirky logic, and the immutable 3 laws of robotics, Bailey sets out to solve the case. But can anything prepare a simple Earthman for the psychological complexities of a world where a beautiful woman could easily have fallen in love with an all-too-human robot? Fresh from his phenomenally successful bestseller, Foundation's Edge, the master returns with a science fiction mystery that brings back the charmingly irascible hero, Elijah Bailey, a character that Asimov fans will remember from his adventures in The Caves of Steel and The Naked Sun. The Robots of Dawn takes us on a mind-stretching journey that recalls, too, the Asimov classic, I, Robot. Other science fiction books by Isaac Asimov: Pebble in the Sky, 1950. The Stars Like Dust, 1951. Foundation, 1951. David Starr, Space Ranger, 1952. Foundation and Empire, 1952. The Currents of Space, 1952. Second Foundation, 1953. Lucky Star and the Pirates of the Asteroids, 1953. Lucky Star and the Oceans of Venus, 1954. The Martian Way and Other Stories, 1955. The End of Eternity, 1955. Lucky Star and the Big Sun of Mercury, 1956. Lucky Star and the Moons of Jupiter, 1957. Earth is Room Enough, 1957. Lucky Star and the Rings of Saturn, 1958. 9 Tomorrows, 1959. The Rest of the Robots, 1964. Fantastic Voyage, 1966. Asimov's Mysteries, 1968. Nightfall and Other Stories, 1969. The Gods Themselves, 1972. The Early Asimov, 1972. The Best of Isaac Asimov, 1973. By Jupiter and Other Stories, 1975. The Bicentennial Man and Other Stories, 1976. The Complete Robot, 1982. The Winds of Change and Other Stories, 1983. Isaac Asimov, The Robots of Dawn. Dedicated to Marvin Minsky and Joseph F. Engelberger, who epitomize, respectively, the theory and practice of robotics. Contents. 1. Bailey, Side 1. 2. Daniil, Side 1. 3. Giscard, Side 2. 4. Fastolf, Side 2. 5. Daniil and Giscard, Side 3. 6. Gladia, Side 4. 7. Again Fastolf, Side 4. 8. Fastolf and Vasilia, Side 5. 9. Vasilia, Side 5. 10. Again Vasilia, Side 6. 11. Gromyanus, Side 6. 12. Again Gromyanus, Side 7. 13. Amadiro, Side 7. 14. Again Amadiro, Side 7. 15. Again Daniil and Giscard, Side 8. 16. Again Gladia, Side 9. 17. The Chairman, Side 9. 18. Again the Chairman, Side 9. 19. Again Bailey, Side 10. The Robots of Dawn. Chapter 1. Bailey. 1. Elijah Bailey found himself in the shade of the tree and muttered to himself, "I knew it. I'm sweating." He paused, straightened up, wiped the perspiration from his brow with the back of his hand, then looked dourly at the moisture that covered it. "I hate sweating," he said to no one, throwing it out as a cosmic law. And once again he felt annoyance with the universe for making something both essential and unpleasant. One never perspired, unless one wished to, of course, in the city, where temperature and humidity were absolutely controlled and where it was never absolutely necessary for the body to perform in ways that made heat production greater than heat removal. Now that was civilized. He looked out into the field, where a straggle of men and women were more or less in his charge. They were mostly youngsters in their late teens, but included some middle-aged people like himself. They were hoeing inexpertly and doing a variety of other things that robots were designed to do, and could do much more efficiently had they not been ordered to stand aside and wait while the human beings stubbornly practiced. There were clouds in the sky, and the sun at the moment was going behind one of them. He looked up uncertainly. On the one hand, it meant the direct heat of the sun and the sweating would be cut down. On the other hand, was there a chance of rain? That was the trouble with the outside. One teetered forever between unpleasant alternatives. It always amazed Bailey that a relatively small cloud could cover the sun completely, darkening earth from horizon to horizon, yet leaving most of the sky blue. He stood beneath the leafy canopy of the tree, a kind of primitive wall and ceiling, with the solidity of the bark comforting to the touch, and looked again at the group, studying it. Once a week they were out there, whatever the weather. They were gaining recruits, too. They were definitely more in number than the stout-hearted few who had started out. The city government, if not an actual partner in the endeavor, was benign enough to raise no obstacles. To the horizon on Bailey's right, eastward, as one could tell by the position of the late afternoon sun, he could see the blunt, many-fingered domes of the city, enclosing all that made life worthwhile. He saw as well a small moving speck that was too far off to be made out clearly. From its manner of motion, and from indications too subtle to describe, Bailey was quite sure it was a robot, but that did not surprise him. The Earth's surface, outside the cities, was the domain of robots, not of human beings, except for those few, like himself, who were dreaming of the stars. Automatically, his eyes turned back toward the hoeing star dreamers and went from one to the other. He could identify and name each one, all working, all learning how to endure the outside, and he frowned and muttered in a low voice, "Where's Bentley?" And another voice, sounding behind with a somewhat breathless exuberance, said, "Here I am, Dad." Bailey whirled. "Don't do that, Ben." "Do what?" sneak up on me like that. It's hard enough trying to keep my equilibrium in the outside without my having to worry about surprises, too. I wasn't trying to surprise you. It's tough to make much noise walking on the grass. One can't help that. But don't you think you ought to go in, Dad? You've been out 2 hours now, and I think you've had enough. Why? Because I'm 45 and you're a punk kid of 19? You think you have to take care of your decrepit father, do you? Ben said, Yes, I guess that's it. And a bit of good detective work on your part, too. You cut right through to the nub. Ben smiled broadly. His face was round, his eyes sparkling. There was a lot of Jesse in him, Bailey thought. A lot of his mother. There was little trace of the length and solemnity of Bailey's own face, and yet Ben had his father's way of thinking. He could at times furrow into a grave solemnity that made it quite clear that he was of perfectly legitimate origin. I'm doing very well, said Bailey. You are, Dad. You're the best of us, considering...
Considering what?
Your age, of course. And I'm not forgetting that you're the one who started this. Still, I saw you take cover under the tree, and I thought, well, maybe the old man has had enough.
I'll old man you, said Bailey.
The robot he had noted in the direction of the city was now close enough to be made out clearly, but Bailey dismissed it as unimportant. He said,
It makes sense to get under a tree once in a while when the sun's too bright. We've got to learn to use the advantages of the outside as well as learning to bear its disadvantages. And there's the sun coming out from behind that cloud.
Yes, it will do that.
Well, then, don't you want to go in? I can stick it out. Once a week, I have an afternoon off, and I spend it here. That's my privilege. It goes with my C7 rating.
It's not a question of privilege, Dad. It's a question of getting overtired.
I feel fine, I tell you.
Sure, and when you get home, you'll go straight to bed and lie in the dark.
Natural antidote to overbrightness.
And Mom worries.
Well, let her worry. It'll do her good. Besides, what's the harm in being out here? The worst part is I sweat. But I just have to get used to it. I can't run away from it. When I started, I couldn't even walk this far from the city without having to turn back. And you were the only one with me. Now look at how many we've got and how far I can come without trouble. I can do plenty of work, too. I can last another hour. Easy.
I tell you, Ben, it would do your mother good to come out here herself. Who, Mom? Surely you jest.
Some jest. When the time comes to take off, I won't be able to go along, because she won't.
And you'll be glad of it. Don't kid yourself, Dad. It won't be for quite a while. And if you're not too old now, you'll be too old then. It's going to be a game for young people.
You know, Bailey said, half balling his fist, you are such a wise guy with your young people. Have you ever been off Earth? Have any of those people in the field been off Earth? I have, 2 years ago. That was before I had any of this acclimatization, and I survived.
I know, Dad, but that was briefly and in the line of duty, and you were taken care of in a going society. It's not the same.
It was the same, said Bailey stubbornly, knowing in his heart that it wasn't. And it won't take us so long to be able to leave. If I could get permission to go to Aurora, we could get this act off the ground.
Forget it. It's not going to happen that easily.
We've got to try. The government won't let us go without Aurora giving us the go-ahead. It's the largest and strongest of the spacer worlds, and what it says
goes. I know, we've all talked this over a million times, but you don't have to go there to get permission. There are such things as hyper-relays. You can talk to them from here. I've said that any number of times before.
It's not the same. We'll need face-to-face contact, and I've said that any number of times before.
In any case, said Ben, we're not ready yet.
We're not ready because Earth won't give us the ships. The spacers will, together with the necessary technical help.
Such faith. Why should the spacers do it? When did they start feeling kindly toward us short-lived Earth people?
If I could talk to them.
Ben laughed. Come on, Dad, you just want to go to Aurora to see that woman again.
Bailey frowned and his eyebrows beetled over his deep-set eyes. Woman? Jehoshaphat, Ben, what are you talking about?
Now, Dad, just between us and not a word to Mom, what did happen with that woman on Solaria? I'm old enough, you can tell me.
What woman on Solaria?
How can you look at me and deny any knowledge of the woman everyone on Earth saw in the hyperwave dramatization? Gladia Delmar, that woman.
Nothing happened. That hyperwave thing was nonsense. I've told you that 1,000 times. She didn't look that way. I didn't look that way. It was all made up, and you know it was produced over my protests, just because the government thought it would put Earth in a good light with the spacers. and you make sure you don't imply anything different to your mother.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Still, this Gladia went to Aurora, and you keep wanting to go there, too. Are you trying to tell me that you honestly think the reason I want to go to Aurora...
Oh, Jehoshaphat!
His son's eyebrows raised.
What's the matter?
The robot. That's R. Geronimo.
Who?
One of our department messenger robots, and it's out here. I'm off time, and I deliberately left my receiver at home because I didn't want them to get at me. That's my C-7 privilege, and yet they send for me by robot.
How do you know it's coming to you, Dad?
By very clever deduction. One, there's no one else here who has any connection with the police department. And two, that miserable thing is heading right toward me. From that, I deduce that it wants me. I should get on the other side of the tree and stay there.
It's not a wall, Dad. The robot can walk around the tree.
And the robot called out, Master Bailey, I have a message for you. You are wanted at headquarters. The robot stopped, waited, then said again, Master Bailey, I have a message for you. You are wanted at headquarters.
I hear and understand, Bailey said tonelessly.
He had to say that, or the robot would have continued to repeat. Bailey frowned slightly as he studied the robot. It was a new model, a little more humaniform than the older models were. It had been uncrated and activated only a month before, and with some degree of fanfare. The government was always trying for something, anything, that might produce more acceptance of robots. It had a grayish surface with a dull finish and a somewhat resilient touch, perhaps like soft leather. The facial expression, while largely changeless, was not quite as idiotic as that of most robots. It was, though, in actual fact, quite as idiotic mentally as all the rest. For a moment, Bailey thought of R. Daniil Oliva, the spacer robot who had been on two assignments with him, one on Earth and one on Solaria, and whom he had last encountered when Daniil had consulted him in the mirror image case. Daniil was a robot who was so human that Bailey could treat him as a friend and could still miss him, even now, if all robots were like that. Bailey said, This is my day off, boy. There is no necessity for me to go to headquarters. R. Geronimo paused. There was a trifling vibration in his hands. Bailey noticed that and was quite aware that it meant a certain amount of conflict in the robot's positronic pathways. They had to obey human beings, but it was quite common for two human beings to want two different types of obedience. The robot made a choice. It said, It is your day off, Master. You are wanted at headquarters. Ben said uneasily,
If they want you, Dad.
Bailey shrugged. Don't be fooled, Ben. If they really wanted me badly, they'd have sent an enclosed car and probably used a human volunteer, instead of ordering a robot to do the walking and irritate me with one of its messages.
Ben shook his head. I don't think so, Dad. They wouldn't know where you were or how long it would take to find you. I don't think they would want to send a human being on an uncertain search.
Yes? Well, let's see how strong the order is. R. Geronimo, go back to headquarters and tell them I'll be at work at 0900. Then, sharply, go back. That's an order. The robot hesitated perceptibly, then turned, moved away, turned again, made an attempt to come back toward Bailey, and finally remained in one spot, its whole body vibrating. Bailey recognized it for what it was and muttered to Ben, I may have to go, Jehoshaphat. What was troubling the robot was what the roboticists called an equipotential of contradiction on the second level. Obedience was the second law, and R. Geronimo was now suffering from two roughly equal and contradictory orders. Robot block was what the general population called it, or more frequently, Roblock for short. Slowly, the robot turned. Its original order was the stronger, but not by much, so that its voice was slurred. Master, I was told you might say that. If so, I was to say... It paused, then added hoarsely, I was to say, if you are alone. Bailey nodded curtly to his son, and Ben didn't wait. He knew when his father was dead, and when he was a policeman. Ben retreated hastily. For a moment, Bailey played irritably with the notion of strengthening his own order and making the roadblock more nearly complete, but that would surely cause the kind of damage that would require positronic analysis and reprogramming. The expense of that would be taken out of his salary, and it might easily amount to a year's pay. He said, I withdraw my order. What were you told to say? R. Geronimo's voice at once cleared. I was told to say that you are wanted in connection with Aurora. Bailey turned toward Ben and called out, Give them another half hour and then say I want them back in. I've got to leave now. And as he walked off with long strides, he said petulantly to the robot, "Why couldn't they tell you to say that at once? And why can't they program you to use a car so that I wouldn't have to walk?" He knew very well why that wasn't done. Any accident involving a robot-driven car would set off another anti-robot riot. He did not slacken his pace. There were 2 kilometers to walk before they even got to the city wall, and thereafter they would have to reach headquarters through heavy traffic. Aurora, what kind of crisis was brewing now? 2. It took half an hour for Bailey to reach the entranceway into the city, and he stiffened himself for what he suspected ahead. Perhaps it wouldn't happen this time. He reached the dividing plane between outside and city, the wall that marked off chaos from civilization. He placed his hand over the signal patch, and an opening appeared. As usual, he didn't wait for the opening to be completed, but slipped in as soon as it was wide enough. R. Geronimo followed. The police sentry on duty looked startled, as he always did when someone came in from outside. Each time there was the same look of disbelief, the same coming to attention, the same sudden hand upon the blaster, the same frown of uncertainty. Bailey presented his identity card with a scowl, and the sentry saluted. The door closed behind him, and it happened. Bailey was inside the city. The walls closed around him, and the city became the universe. He was again immersed in the endless, eternal hum and odor of people and machinery that would soon fade below the threshold of consciousness. In the soft, indirect artificial light that was nothing at all like the partial and varying glare of the outside, with its green and brown and blue and white and its interruptions of red and yellow, here there was no erratic wind, no heat, no cold, no threat of rain. Here there was instead the quiet permanence of unfelt air currents that kept everything fresh. Here was a designed combination of temperature and humidity so perfectly adjusted to humans, it remained unsensed. Bailey felt his breath drawn in tremulously, and he gladdened in the realization that he was home and safe with the known and knowable. That was what always happened. Again he had accepted the city as the womb and moved back into it with glad relief. He knew that such a womb was something from which humanity must emerge and be born. Why did he always sink back this way? And would that always be? Would it really be that, though he might lead countless numbers out of the city and off the earth and out of the stars, he would not in the end be able to go himself? Would he always feel at home only in the city? He clenched his teeth. But there was no use thinking about it. He said to the robot, "Were you brought to this point by car, boy?" "Yes, master." "Where is it now?" "I do not know, master." Bailey turned to the sentry. "Officer, this robot was brought to this spot 2 hours ago. What has happened to the car that brought him?"
"Sir, I went on duty less than an hour ago."
Actually, it was foolish to ask. Those in the car did not know how long it would take the robot to find him, so they would not wait. Bailey had a brief impulse to call in, but they would tell him to take the expressway. It would be quicker. The only reason he hesitated was the presence of R. Geronimo. He didn't want its company on the expressway, and yet he could not expect the robot to make its way back to headquarters through hostile crowds. Not that he had a choice. Undoubtedly, the commissioner was not eager to make this easy for him. He would be annoyed at not having had him on call, free time or not. Bailey said, "This way, boy." The city covered over 5,000 square kilometers and contained over 400 kilometers of expressway, plus hundreds of kilometers of feederway to serve its well over 20 million people. The intricate net of movement existed on 8 levels, and there were hundreds of interchanges of varying degrees of complexity. As a plainclothesman, Bailey was expected to know them all, and he did. Put him down blindfolded in any corner of the city, whip off the blindfold, and he could make his way flawlessly to any other designated portion. There was no question then but that he knew how to get to headquarters. There were 8 reasonable routes he could follow, however, and for a moment he hesitated over which might be least crowded at this time. Only for a moment. Then he decided and said, "Come with me, boy." The robot followed docilely at his heels. They swung onto a passing feeder, and Bailey seized one of the vertical poles, white, warm, and textured to give a good grip. Bailey did not want to sit down. They would not be on for long. The robot had waited for Bailey's quick gesture before placing its hand upon the same pole. It might as well have remained standing without a grip. It would not have been difficult to maintain balance. But Bailey wanted to take no chance of being separated. He was responsible for the robot and did not wish to risk being asked to replace the financial loss to the city should anything happen to R. Geronimo. The feeder had a few other people on board, and the eyes of each turned curiously and inevitably to the robot. One by one, Bailey caught those glances. Bailey had the look of one used to authority, and the eyes he caught turned uneasily away. Bailey gestured again as he swung off the feeder. It had reached the strips now and was moving at the same speed as the nearest strip, so that there was no necessity for it to slow down. Bailey stepped onto that nearest strip and felt the whipping of air once they were no longer protected by plastic enclosure. He leaned into the wind with the ease of long practice, lifting one arm to break the force at eye level. He ran the strips downward to the intersection with the expressway and then began the run upward to the speed strip that bordered the expressway. He heard the teenage cry of, "Robot!" He had been a teenager himself once, and knew exactly what would happen. A group of them, two or three or half a dozen, would swarm up or down the strips, and somehow the robot would be tripped and would go clanging down. Then, if it ever came before a magistrate, any teenager taken into custody would claim the robot had collided with him and was a menace on the strips, and would undoubtedly be let go. The robot could neither defend itself in the first instance, nor testify in the second. Bailey moved rapidly and was between the first of the teenagers and the robot. He sidestepped onto a faster strip, brought his arm higher as though to adjust to the increase in wind speed, and somehow the young man was nudged off course and onto a slower strip for which he was not prepared. He called out wildly, "Hey!" as he went sprawling. The others stopped, assessed the situation quickly, and veered away. Bailey said, "Onto the expressway, boy." The robot hesitated briefly. Robots were not allowed unaccompanied on the expressway. Bailey's order had been a firm one, however, and it moved aboard. Bailey followed, which relieved the pressure on the robot. Bailey moved brusquely through the crowd of standees, forcing R. Geronimo ahead of him, making his way up to the less crowded upper level. He held onto a pole and kept one foot firmly on the robots, again glaring down, all eye contact. 15.5 kilometers brought him to the close point for the police headquarters, and he was off. R. Geronimo came off with him. It hadn't been touched, not a scuff. Bailey delivered it at the door and accepted a receipt. He carefully checked the date, the time, and the robot's serial number, then placed the receipt in his wallet. Before the day was over, he would check and make certain that the transaction had been computer registered. Now he was going to see the commissioner, and he knew the commissioner. Any failing on Bailey's part would be suitable cause for demotion. He was a harsh man, the commissioner. He considered Bailey's past triumphs a personal offense. 3. The commissioner was Wilson Roth. He had held the post for 2.5 years, since Julius Enderby had resigned once the furor roused by the murder of a spacer had subsided and the resignation could be safely offered. Bailey had never quite reconciled himself to the change. Julius, with all his shortcomings, had been a friend as well as a superior. Roth was merely a superior. He was not even city bred, not this city. He had been brought in from outside. Roth was neither unusually tall nor unusually fat. His head was large, though, and seemed to be set on a neck that slanted slightly forward from his torso. It made him appear heavy, heavy-bodied and heavy-headed. He even had heavy lids half obscuring his eyes. Anyone would think him sleepy, but he never missed anything. Bailey had found that out very soon after Roth had taken over the office. He was under no illusion that Roth liked him. He was under less illusion that he liked Roth. Roth did not sound petulant, he never did, but his words did not exude pleasure, either. "Bailey, why is it so hard to find you?" he said. Bailey said in a carefully respectful voice, "It is my afternoon off, Commissioner." "Yes, your C-7 privilege. You've heard of a waiver, haven't you? Something that receives official messages? You are subject to recall even on your off time." "I know that very well, Commissioner, but there are no longer any regulations concerning the wearing of a waiver. We can be reached without one." "Inside the city, yes, but you were outside, or am I mistaken?" "You are not mistaken, Commissioner. I was outside. The regulations do not state that in such a case I am to wear a waiver." "You hide behind the letter of the statute, do you?"
"Yes, Commissioner," said Bailey calmly.
The commissioner rose, a powerful and vaguely threatening man, and sat on the desk. The window to the outside, which Enderby had installed, had long been closed off and painted over. In the closed-in room, warmer and more comfortable for that, the commissioner seemed the larger. He said, without raising his voice, "You rely, Bailey, on Earth's gratitude, I think."
I rely on doing my job, Commissioner, as best I can and in accord with the regulations.
And on Earth's gratitude when you bend the spirit of those regulations.
Bailey said nothing to that. The Commissioner said,
You are considered as having done well in the Sartan murder case 3 years ago.
Thank you, Commissioner, said Bailey. The dismantling of Spacetown was a consequence, I believe.
It was, and that was something applauded by all Earth. You are also considered as having done well on Solaria 2 years ago, and before you remind me, the result was a revision in the terms of the trade treaties with the spacer worlds to the considerable advantage of Earth.
I believe that is on record, sir.
And you are very much the hero as a result.
I make no such claim.
You have received 2 promotions, one in the aftermath of each affair. There has even been a hyperwave drama based on the events on Solaria.
Which was produced without my permission and against my will, Commissioner.
Which nevertheless made you a kind of hero.
Bailey shrugged. The Commissioner, having waited for a spoken comment for a few seconds, went on,
But you have done nothing of importance in nearly 2 years.
It is natural for Earth to ask what I have done for it lately.
Exactly. It probably does ask. It knows that you are a leader in this new fad of venturing outside, in fiddling with the soil, and in pretending to be a robot.
It is permitted.
Not all that is permitted is admired. It is possible that more people think of you as peculiar than as heroic.
That is perhaps in accord with my own opinion of myself, said Bailey.
The public has a notoriously short memory. The heroic is vanishing rapidly behind the peculiar in your case, so that if you make a mistake, you will be in serious trouble. The reputation you rely on...
With respect, Commissioner, I do not rely on it.
The reputation the police department feels you rely on will not save you, and I will not be able to save you.
The shadow of a smile seemed to pass for one moment over Bailey's dour features. I would not want you, Commissioner, to risk your position in a wild attempt to save me. The Commissioner shrugged and produced a smile precisely as shadowy and fleeting.
You need not worry about that.
Then why are you telling me all this, Commissioner?
To warn you. I am not trying to destroy you, you understand. So I am warning you once. You are going to be involved in a very delicate matter in which you may easily make a mistake. And I am warning you that you must not make one.
Here his face relaxed into an unmistakable smile. Bailey did not respond to the smile. He said, Can you tell me what the very delicate matter is?
I do not know.
Does it involve Aurora?
R. Geronimo was instructed to tell you that it did, if it had to, but I know nothing about it.
Then how can you tell, Commissioner, that it is a very delicate matter?
Come, Bailey, you are an investigator of mysteries. What brings a member of the Terrestrial Department of Justice to the city... when you might easily have been asked to go to Washington, as you did 2 years ago in connection with the Solaria incident. And what makes the person from Justice frown and seem ill-tempered and grow impatient at the fact that you were not reached instantly? Your decision to make yourself unavailable was a mistake, one that was in no way my responsibility. It is perhaps not fatal in itself, but you are off on the wrong foot, I believe.
You are delaying me further, however, said Bailey, frowning.
Not really. The official from Justice is having some light refreshment. You know the perks that the Terries allow themselves. We will be joined when that is done. The news of your arrival has been transmitted, so just continue to wait, as I am doing.
Bailey waited. He had known at the time that the hyperwave drama forced upon him against his will, however it might have helped Earth's position, had ruined him in the department. It had cast him in 3-dimensional relief against the 2-dimensional flatness of the organization, and had made him a marked man. He had risen to higher rank and greater privileges, but that, too, had increased department hostility against him. And the higher he rose, the more easily he would shatter in case of a fall. If he made a mistake... 4. The official from Justice entered, looked about casually, walked to the other side of Roth's desk, and took the seat. As highest classified individual, the official behaved properly. Roth calmly took a secondary seat. Bailey remained standing, laboring to keep his face unsurprised. Roth might have warned him, but he had not. He had clearly chosen his words deliberately in order to give no sign. The official was a woman. There was no reason for this not to be. Any official might be a woman. The Secretary General might be a woman. There were women on the police force, even a woman with the rank of captain. It was just that, without warning, one didn't expect it in any given case. There were times in history when women entered administrative posts in considerable numbers. Bailey knew that. He knew history well, but this wasn't one of those times. She was quite tall and sat stiffly upright in the chair. Her uniform was not very different from that of a man, nor was her hair styling or facial adornment. What gave her sex away immediately were her breasts, the prominence of which she made no attempt to hide. She was 40-ish, her facial features regular and cleanly chiseled. She had middle-aged attractively, with as yet no visible gray in her dark hair. She said, "You are plainclothesman Elijah Bailey, classification C7. It was a statement, not a question. "Yes, ma'am," Bailey answered, nevertheless. "I'm Undersecretary Lavinia Demichek. You don't look very much as you did in that hyperwave drama concerning you." Bailey had been told that often. "They couldn't very well portray me as I am and collect much of an audience, ma'am," said Bailey dryly. "I'm not sure of that. You look stronger than the baby-faced actor they used." Bailey hesitated a second or so and decided to take the chance, or perhaps felt he couldn't resist taking it. Solemnly, he said, "You have a cultivated taste, ma'am." She laughed, and Bailey let out his breath very gently. She said, "I'd like to think I have. Now, what do you mean by keeping me waiting?" "I was not informed you would come, ma'am, and it was off time for me." "Which you spent outside, I understand." "Yes, ma'am." "You are one of those cranks, as I would say, were my taste not a cultivated one. Let me ask instead if you are one of those enthusiasts." "Yes, ma'am." "You expect to emigrate someday and found new worlds in the wildernesses of the galaxy?" "Perhaps not I, ma'am. I may prove to be too old, but..."
"How old are you?"
45, ma'am."
"Well, you look it. I am 45 also, as it happens."
"You do not look it, ma'am."
"Older or younger?"
She broke into laughter again, then said, "But let's not play games. Do you imply I am too old to be a pioneer?" "No one can be a pioneer in our society without training outside. The training works best with the young. My son, I hope, will someday stand on another world."
"Indeed?
You know, of course, that the galaxy belongs to the spacer worlds." "There are only 50 of them, ma'am. There are millions of worlds in the galaxy that are habitable, or can be made habitable, and that probably do not possess indigenous intelligent life."
"Yes, but not one ship can leave Earth without spacer permission."
"That might be granted, ma'am."
"I do not share your optimism, Mr. Bailey."
"I have spoken to spacers who..."
"I know you have," said Demichek. "My superior is Albert Minim, who 2 years ago sent you to Solaria." She permitted herself a small curve of the lips. "An actor portrayed him in a bit role on that hyperwave drama, one that resembled him closely, as I recall. He was not pleased, as I also recall." Bailey changed the subject. "I asked Undersecretary Minim..."
"He has been promoted, you know."
Bailey thoroughly understood the importance of grades in classification.
"His new title, ma'am?"
"Vice Secretary."
"Thank you. I asked Vice Secretary Minim to request permission for me to visit Aurora to deal with this subject."
"When?"
"Not very long after my return from Solaria. I have renewed the request twice since."
"But have not received a favorable reply?"
"No, ma'am."
"Are you surprised?"
"I am disappointed, ma'am."
"No point in that." She leaned back a trifle in the chair. "Our relationship with the spacer worlds is very touchy. You may feel that your two feats of detection have eased the situation, and so they have. That awful hyperwave drama has also helped. The total easing, however, has been this much." She placed her thumb and forefinger close together. "Out of this much." And she spread her hands far apart. "Under those circumstances," she went on, "we could scarcely take the risk of sending you to Aurora, the leading spacer world, and having you perhaps do something that could create interstellar tension." Bailey's eyes met hers. "I have been on Solaria and have done no harm. On the contrary..."
"Yes, I know, but you were there at spacer request, which is parsecs distant from being there at our request. You cannot fail to see that."
Bailey was silent. She made a soft snorting sound of non-surprise and said, The situation has grown worse since your requests were placed with, and very correctly ignored by, the Vice Secretary. It has grown particularly worse in the last month. Is that the reason for this conference, ma'am? Do you grow impatient, sir? She addressed him sardonically in the to a superior intonation. Do you direct me to come to the point? No, ma'am. Certainly you do, and why not? I grow tedious. Let me approach the point by asking if you know Dr. Han Fastolf. Bailey said carefully, I met him once nearly 3 years ago in what was then Spacetown. You liked him, I believe. He was friendly for a spacer. She made another soft, snorting sound. I imagine so. Are you aware that he has been an important political power on Aurora over the last 2 years?
I had heard he was in the government from a partner I once had.
From R. Daniil Oliva, your spacer robot friend?
My ex-partner, ma'am.
On the occasion when you solved a small problem concerning two mathematicians on board a spacer ship? Bailey nodded.
Yes, ma'am.
We keep informed, you see. Dr. Han Fastolf has been, more or less, the guiding light of the Auroran government for 2 years, an important figure in their world legislature, and he is even spoken of as a possible future chairman. The chairman, you understand, is the closest thing to a chief executive that the Aurorans have. Bailey said, yes, ma'am, and wondered when she would get to the very delicate matter of which the commissioner had spoken. Demichek seemed in no hurry. She said, Fastolf is a moderate. That's what he calls himself. He feels Aurora, and the spacer worlds generally, have gone too far in their direction, as you perhaps feel that we on Earth have gone too far in ours. He wishes to step backward to less robotry, to a more rapid turnover of generations, and to alliance and friendship with Earth. Naturally, we support him, but very quietly. If we were too demonstrative in our affection, that might well be the kiss of death for him. Bailey said, I believe he would support Earth's exploration and settlement of other worlds. I believe so, too. I am of the opinion he said as much to you.
Yes, ma'am, when we met.
Demichek steepled her hands and put the tips of her fingers to her chin. Do you think he represents public opinion on the spacer worlds?
I don't know, ma'am.
I'm afraid he does not. Those who are with him are lukewarm. Those who are against him are an ardent legion. It is only his political skills and his personal warmth that have kept him as close to the seats of power as he is. His greatest weakness, of course, is his sympathy for Earth, that is constantly used against him, and it influences many who would share his views in every other respect. If you were sent to Aurora, any mistake you made would help strengthen anti-Earth feeling and would therefore weaken him, possibly fatally. Earth simply cannot take that risk. Bailey muttered,
I see.
Fastolf is willing to take the risk. It was he who arranged to have you sent to Solaria at a time when his political power was barely beginning and when he was very vulnerable. But then he has only his personal power to lose, whereas we must be concerned with the welfare of over 8 billion Earth people. That is what makes the present political situation almost unbearably delicate. She paused, and finally, Bailey was forced to ask the question.
What is the situation that you are referring to, ma'am?
It seems, said Demichek, that Fastolf has become implicated in a serious and unprecedented scandal. If he is clumsy, the chances are that he will undergo political destruction in a matter of weeks. If he is superhumanly clever, perhaps he will hold out for some months. A little sooner, a little later, he could be destroyed as a political force on Aurora. And that would be a real disaster for Earth, you see.
May I ask what he is accused of? Corruption? Treason?
Nothing that small. His personal integrity is in any case unquestioned even by his enemies.
A crime of passion, then? Murder?
Not quite murder.
I don't understand, ma'am.
There are human beings on Aurora, Mr. Bailey. And there are robots, too. Most of them something like ours, not very much more advanced in most cases. However, there are a few humaniform robots. Robots so humaniform that they can be taken for human.
Bailey nodded. I know that very well.
I suppose that destroying a humaniform robot is not exactly murder in the strict sense of the word. Bailey leaned forward, eyes widening. He shouted, Jehoshaphat, woman, stop playing games. Are you telling me that Dr. Fastolf has killed R. Daniil? Roth leaped to his feet and seemed about to advance on Bailey, but Under-Secretary Demichek waved him back. She seemed unruffled. She said, "Under the circumstances, I excuse your disrespect, Bailey. No, our Daniil has not been killed. He is not the only humaniform robot on Aurora. Another such robot, not our Daniil, has been killed, if you wish to use the term loosely. To be more precise, its mind has been totally destroyed. It was placed into permanent and irreversible roadblock." Bailey said, "And they say that Dr. Fastolf did it?" "His enemies are saying so. The extremists who wish only spacers to spread through the galaxy and who wish Earth people to vanish from the universe are saying so. If these extremists can maneuver another election within the next few weeks, they will surely gain total control of the government with incalculable results." "Why is this roadblock so important politically? I don't understand." "I am not myself certain," said Demichek. "I do not pretend to understand Auroran politics. I gather that the humaniforms were in some way involved with the extremist plans, and that the destruction has infuriated them." She wrinkled her nose. "I find their politics very confusing, and I will only mislead you if I try to interpret it." Bailey labored to control himself under the undersecretary's level stare. He said in a low voice, "Why am I here?" "Because of Fastolf. Once before, you went out into space in order to solve a murder, and succeeded. Fastolf wants you to try again. You are to go to Aurora and discover who is responsible for the roadblock. He feels that to be his only chance of turning back the extremists." "I am not a roboticist. I know nothing about Aurora."
"You knew nothing about Solaria either, yet you managed. The point is, Bailey, we are as eager to find out what really happened as Fastolf is. We don't want him destroyed. If he is, Earth will be subject to a kind of hostility from these spacer extremists that will probably be greater than anything we have yet experienced. We don't want that to happen."
"I can't take on this responsibility, ma'am. The task is..."
"Next to impossible.
We know that. But we have no choice. Fastolf insists, and behind him for the moment stands the Auroran government. If you refuse to go, or if we refuse to let you go, we will have to face the Auroran fury. If you do go and are successful, we'll be saved and you will be suitably rewarded."
"And if I go and fail?"
"We will do our best to see to it that the blame will be yours and not Earth's."
"The skins of officialdom will be saved, in other words."
Demichek said, "A kinder way of putting it is that you will be thrown to the wolves in the hope that Earth will not suffer too badly. One man is not a bad price to pay for our planet."
"It seems to me that since I am sure to fail, I might as well not go."
"You know better than that," said Demichek softly. "Aurora has asked for you, and you cannot refuse. And why should you want to refuse? You've been trying to go to Aurora for 2 years, and you've been bitter over your failure to get our permission."
"I've wanted to go in peace, to arrange for help in the settlement of other worlds, not to..."
"You might still try to get their help for your dream of settling other worlds, Bailey. After all, suppose you do succeed. It's possible, after all. In that case, Fastolf will be much beholden to you, and he may do far more for you than he ever would have otherwise, and we ourselves will be sufficiently grateful to you to help. Isn't that worth a risk, even a large one? However small your chances of success are if you go, those chances are zero if you do not go. Think of that, Bailey, but please, not too long." Bailey's lips tightened, and finally, realizing there was no alternative, he said, "How much time do I have to..."
And Demichek said calmly, "Come. Haven't I been explaining that we have no choice and no time either? You leave..."
She looked at the time band on her wrist.
"In just under 6 hours."
5. The spaceport was at the eastern outskirts of the city, in an all-but-deserted sector that was, strictly speaking, outside. This was palliated by the fact that the ticket offices and the waiting rooms were actually in the city, and that the approach to the ship itself was by vehicle through a covered path. By tradition, all takeoffs were at night, so that a pall of darkness further deadened the effect of outside. The spaceport was not very busy, considering the populous character of Earth. Earthmen very rarely left the planet, and the traffic consisted entirely of commercial activity organized by robots and spacers. Elijah Bailey, waiting for the ship to be ready for boarding, felt already cut off from Earth. Bentley sat with him, and there was a glum silence between the two.
Finally, Ben said, I didn't think Mom would want to come. Bailey nodded.
I didn't think so either. I remember how she was when I went to Solaria. This is no different.
Did you manage to calm her down?
I did what I could, Ben. She thinks I'm bound to be in a space crash or that the spacers will kill me once I'm on Aurora.
You got back from Solaria?
That just makes her the less eager to risk me a second time. She assumes the luck will run out. However, she'll manage. You rally round, Ben. Spend some time with her, and whatever you do, don't talk about heading out to settle a new planet. That's what really bothers her, you know. She feels you'll be leaving her one of these years. She knows she won't be able to go, and so she'll never see you again.
She may not, said Ben. That's the way it might work out.
You can face that easily, maybe, but she can't, so just don't discuss it while I'm gone, all right?
All right. I think she's a little upset about Gladia.
Bailey looked up sharply. Have you been?
I haven't said a word. But she saw that hyperwave thing, too, you know, and she knows Gladia's on Aurora.
What of it? It's a big planet. Do you think Gladia Delmar will be waiting at the spaceport for me?
Jehoshaphat, Ben, doesn't your mother know that hyperwave axle grease was 9/10 fiction?
Ben changed the subject with a tangible effort.
It seems funny, you sitting here with no luggage of any kind.
I'm sitting here with too much. I've got the clothes I'm wearing, don't I? They'll get rid of those as soon as I'm on board. Off they go to be chemically treated, then dumped into space. After that, they'll give me a totally new wardrobe, after I have been personally fumigated and cleaned and polished inside and out. I've been through that once before.
Again, silence, and then Ben said, You know, Dad... And stopped suddenly. He tried again. You know, Dad... And did no better.
Bailey looked at him steadily. What are you trying to say, Ben?
Dad... I feel like an awful jackass saying this, but I think I'd better. You're not the hero type. Even I never thought you were. You're a nice guy and the best father there could be, but not the hero type.
Bailey grunted.
Still, said Ben, when you stop to think of it, it was you who got Spacetown off the map. It was you who got Aurora on our side. It was you who started this whole project of settling other worlds. Dad, you've done more for Earth than everyone in the government put together. So why aren't you appreciated more?
Bailey said, Because I'm not the hero type, and because this stupid hyperwave drama was foisted on me. It has made an enemy of every man in the department, it's unsettled your mother, and it's given me a reputation I can't live up to. The lights flashed on his wrist collar, and he stood up. I've got to go now, Ben.
I know, but what I want to say, Dad, is that I appreciate you. And this time, when you come back... You'll get that from everybody, and not just from me.
Bailey felt himself melting. He nodded rapidly, put a hand on his son's shoulder, and muttered, Thanks. Take care of yourself and your mother while I'm gone. He walked away, not looking back. He had told Ben that he was going to Aurora to discuss the settlement project. If that were so, he might come back in triumph. As it was, he thought, I'll come back in disgrace. If I come back at all.
Chapter 2. Daniil. 6. It was Bailey's third time on a spaceship, and the passage of 2 years had in no way dimmed his memory of the first two times. He knew exactly what to expect. There would be the isolation, the fact that no one would see him or have anything to do with him, with the exception, perhaps, of a robot. There would be the constant medical treatment, the fumigation and sterilization. No other way of putting it. There would be the attempt to make him fit to approach the disease-conscious spacers who thought of Earth people as walking bags of multifarious infections. There would be differences, too, however. He would not, this time, be quite so afraid of the process. Surely the feeling of loss at being out of the womb would be less dreadful. He would be prepared for the wider surroundings. This time, he told himself boldly, but with a small knot in his stomach for all that. He might even be able to insist on being given a view of space. Would it look different from photographs of the night sky seen from outside, he wondered. He remembered his first view of a planetarium dome, safely within the city, of course. Yet it had given him no sensation of being outside, no discomfort at all. Then there were the two times, no, three, that he had been in the open at night and saw the real stars in the real dome of the sky.
That had been far less impressive than the planetarium dome had been, but there had been a cool wind each time and a feeling of distance, which made it more frightening than the dome, but less frightening than daytime, for the darkness was a comforting wall about him. Would, then, the sight of the stars through a spaceship viewing window seem more like a planetarium, or more like Earth's night sky, or would it be a different sensation altogether? He concentrated on that, as though to wash out the thought of leaving Jesse, Ben, and the city. With nothing less than bravado, he refused the car and insisted on walking the short distance from the gate to the ship in the company of the robot who had come for him. It was just a roofed-over arcade, after all. The passage was slightly curved, and he looked back while he could still see Ben at the other end. He lifted his hand casually, as though he were taking the expressway to Trenton, and Ben waved both arms wildly, holding up the first two fingers of each hand outspread in the ancient symbol of victory. Victory? A useless gesture, Bailey was certain. He switched to another thought that might serve to fill and occupy him. What would it be like to board a spaceship by day, with the sun shining brightly on its metal, and with himself and the others who were boarding all exposed to the outside? How would it feel to be entirely aware of a tiny cylindrical world, one that would detach itself from the infinitely larger world to which it was temporarily attached, and that would then lose itself in an outside infinitely larger than any outside on Earth, until after an endless stretch of nothingness, it would find another... He held himself grimly to a steady walk, letting no change in expression show, or so he thought at least. The robot at his side, however, brought him to a halt. "Are you ill, sir?" "Not master, merely sir. It was an Auroran robot." "I'm all right, boy," said Bailey hoarsely. "Move on." He kept his eyes turned to the ground and did not lift them again till the ship itself was towering above him. An Auroran ship. He was sure of that. Outlined by a warm spotlight, it soared taller, more gracefully, and yet more powerfully than the Solarian ships had. Bailey moved inside, and the comparison remained in favor of Aurora. His room was larger than the ones 2 years before had been, more luxurious, more comfortable. He knew exactly what was coming, and removed all his clothes without hesitation. Perhaps they would be disintegrated by plasma torch. Certainly he would not get them back on returning to Earth, if he returned. He hadn't the first time. He would receive no other clothes till he had been thoroughly bathed, examined, dosed, and injected. He almost welcomed the humiliating procedures imposed on him. After all, it served to keep his mind off what was taking place. He was scarcely aware of the initial acceleration, and scarcely had time to think of the moment during which he left Earth and entered space. When he was finally dressed again, he surveyed the results unhappily in a mirror. The material, whatever it was smooth and reflective, and shifted color with any change in angle. The trouser legs hugged his ankles and were in turn covered by the tops of shoes that molded themselves softly to his feet. The sleeves of his blouse hugged his wrists, and his hands were covered by thin, transparent gloves. The top of the blouse covered his neck, and an attached hood could, if desired, cover his head. He was being so covered, not for his own comfort, he knew, but to reduce his danger to the spacers. He thought, as he looked at the outfit, that he should feel uncomfortably enclosed, uncomfortably hot, uncomfortably damp, but he did not. He wasn't, to his enormous relief, even sweating. He made the reasonable deduction. He said to the robot that had walked him to the ship and was still with him, "Boy, are these clothes temperature controlled?" The robot said, "Indeed they are, sir. It is all-weather clothing and is considered very desirable. It is also exceedingly expensive. Few on Aurora are in a position to wear it." "That's so, Jehoshaphat." He stared at the robot. It seemed a fairly primitive model, not very much different from Earth models, in fact. Still, there was a certain subtlety of expression that Earth models lacked. It could change expression in a limited way, for instance. It had smiled very slightly when it indicated that Bailey had been given that which few on Aurora could afford. The structure of its body resembled metal, and yet had the look of something woven, something shifting slightly with movement, something with colors that matched and contrasted pleasingly. In short, unless one looked very closely and steadily, the robot, though definitely non-humaniform, seemed to be wearing clothing. Bailey said, "What ought I to call you, boy?"
"I am Giscard, sir."
"R. Giscard?"
"If you wish, sir."
Do you have a library on this ship?
Yes, sir.
Can you get me book films on Aurora?
What kind, sir?
Histories, political science, geographies, anything that will let me know about the planet.
Yes, sir.
And a viewer.
Yes, sir.
The robot left through the double door, and Bailey nodded grimly to himself. On his trip to Solaria, it had never occurred to him to spend the useless time crossing space in learning something useful. He had come along a bit in the last 2 years. He tried the door the robot had just passed through. It was locked and utterly without give. He would have been enormously surprised at anything else. He investigated the room. There was a hyperwave screen. He handled the controls idly, received a blast of music, managed to lower the volume eventually, and listened with disapproval. Tinkly and discordant, the instruments of the orchestra seemed vaguely distorted. He touched other contacts and finally managed to change the view. What he saw was a space soccer game that was played, obviously, under conditions of zero gravity. The ball flew in straight lines, and the players, too many of them on each side, with fins on backs, elbows, and knees that must serve to control movement, soared in graceful sweeps. The unusual movements made Bailey feel dizzy. He leaned forward and had just found and used the off switch when he heard the door open behind him. He turned, and because he thoroughly expected to see R. Giscard, he was aware at first only of someone who was not R. Giscard. It took a blink or two to realize that he saw a thoroughly human shape, with a broad, high-cheekboned face, and with short bronze hair lying flatly backward, someone dressed in clothing with a conservative cut and color scheme. "Jehoshaphat," said Bailey in a nearly strangled voice.
"Partner Elijah," said the other, stepping forward, a small, grave smile on his face.
"Daniil," cried Bailey, throwing his arms around the robot and hugging tightly. "Daniil."
7.
Bailey continued to hold Daniil, the one unexpected, familiar object on the ship, the one strong link to the past. He clung to Daniil in a gush of relief and affection. And then, little by little, he collected his thoughts and knew that he was hugging not Daniil, but R. Daniil, Robot Daniil Oliva. He was hugging a robot, and the robot was holding him lightly, allowing himself to be hugged, judging that the action gave pleasure to a human being, and enduring that action because the positronic potentials of his brain made it impossible to repel the embrace and so cause disappointment and embarrassment to the human being. The insurmountable first law of robotics states, a robot may not injure a human being, and to repel a friendly gesture would do injury. Slowly, so as to reveal no sign of his own chagrin, Bailey released his hold. He even gave each upper arm of the robot a final squeeze, so that there might seem to be no shame to the release. "Haven't seen you, Daniil," said Bailey, "since you brought that ship to Earth with the two mathematicians, remember?"
"Of a certainty, partner Elijah. It is a pleasure to see you."
"You feel emotion, do you?" said Bailey lightly.
"I cannot say what I feel in any human sense, partner Elijah. I can say, however, that the sight of you seems to make my thoughts flow more easily, and the gravitational pull on my body seems to assault my senses with lesser insistence, and that there are other changes I can identify. I imagine that what I sense corresponds in a rough way to what it is that you may sense when you feel pleasure."
Bailey nodded. "Whatever it is you sense when you see me, old partner, that makes it seem preferable to the state in which you are when you don't see me, suits me well, if you follow my meaning. But how is it you are here?"
"Giscard Reventlov, having reported you..." R. Daniil paused.
"Purified?" asked Bailey sardonically.
"Disinfected," said R. Daniil. I felt it appropriate to enter then.
"Surely you would not fear infection otherwise?"
"Not at all, partner Elijah. But others on the ship might then be reluctant to have me approach them. The people of Aurora are sensitive to the chance of infection, sometimes to a point beyond a rational estimate of the probabilities."
"I understand, but I wasn't asking why you were here at this moment. I meant, why are you here at all?"
"Dr. Fastolf, of whose establishment I am part, directed me to board the ship that had been sent to pick you up for several reasons. He felt it desirable that you have one immediate item of the known in what he was certain would be a difficult mission for you."
"That was a kindly thought on his part. I thank him."
R. Daniil bowed gravely in acknowledgment.
Dr. Fastoff also felt that the meeting would give me, the robot paused, appropriate sensations.
Pleasure, you mean, Daniil?
Since I am permitted to use the term, yes. And as a third reason, and the most important... The door opened again at that point, and R. Giscard walked in. Bailey's head turned toward it, and he felt a surge of displeasure. There was no mistaking R. Giscard as a robot, and its presence emphasized somehow the robotism of Daniil, R. Daniil, Bailey suddenly thought again, even though Daniil was far the superior of the two. Bailey didn't want the robotism of Daniil emphasized. He didn't want himself humiliated for his inability to regard Daniil as anything but a human being with a somewhat stilted way with the language. He said impatiently, "What is it, boy?" R. Giscard said, "I have brought the book films you wish to see, sir, and the viewer."
"Well, put them down. Put them down. And you needn't stay. Daniil will be here with me."
"Yes, sir." The robot's eyes, faintly glowing, Bailey noticed, as Daniil's were not, turned briefly to R. Daniil, as though seeking orders from a superior being. R. Daniil said quietly, "It will be appropriate, friend Giscard, to remain just outside the door." "I shall, friend Daniil," said R. Giscard.
It left, and Bailey said with some discontent, "Why does it have to stay just outside the door? Am I a prisoner?"
"In the sense," said R. Daniil, "that it would not be permitted for you to mingle with the ship's company in the course of this voyage, I regret to be forced to say you are indeed a prisoner. Yet that is not the reason for the presence of Giscard. And I should tell you at this point that it might well be advisable, Partner Elijah, if you did not address Giscard or any robot as boy."
Bailey frowned. "Does it resent the expression?"
"Giscard does not resent any action of a human being. It is simply that boy is not a customary term of address for robots on Aurora, and it would be inadvisable to create friction with the Aurorans by unintentionally stressing your place of origin through habits of speech that are non-essential."
"How do I address it, then?"
"As you address me, by the use of his accepted identifying name. That is, after all, merely a sound indicating the particular person you are addressing. And why should one sound be preferable to another? It is merely a matter of convention, and it is also the custom on Aurora to refer to a robot as he, or sometimes she, rather than as it. Then, too, it is not the custom on Aurora to use the initial R, except under formal conditions where the entire name of the robot is appropriate, and even then the initial is nowadays often left out."
"In that case, Daniil..." Bailey repressed the sudden impulse to say, "R. Daniil, how do you distinguish between robots and human beings?"
"The distinction is usually self-evident, Partner Elijah. There would seem to be no need to emphasize it unnecessarily. At least that is the Auroran view. And since you have asked Giscard for films on Aurora, I assume you wish to familiarize yourself with things Auroran as an aid to the task you have undertaken."
"The task which has been dumped on me, yes. And what if the distinction between robot and human being is not self-evident, Daniil, as in your case?"
"Then why make the distinction, unless the situation is such that it is essential to make it?" Bailey took a deep breath. It was going to be difficult to adjust to this Auroran pretense that robots did not exist. He said, "But then if Giscard is not here to keep me prisoner, why is it he outside the door?" "Those are according to instructions of Dr. Fastoff, Partner Elijah. Giscard is to protect you."
"Protect me? Against what, or against whom?"
"Dr. Fastoff was not precise on that point, Partner Elijah. Still, as human passions are running high over the matter of gender panel..."
"Gender panel?"
"The robot whose usefulness was terminated."
"The robot, in other words, who was killed?"
"Killed, Partner Elijah, is a term that is usually applied to human beings."
"But on Aurora, distinctions between robots and human beings are avoided, are they not?"
"So they are. Nevertheless, the possibility of distinction or lack of distinction in the particular case of the ending of functioning has never arisen, to my knowledge. I do not know what the rules are." Bailey pondered the matter.
It was a point of no real importance, purely a matter of semantics. Still, he wanted to probe the manner of thinking of the Aurorans. He would get nowhere otherwise. He said slowly,
"A human being who is functioning is alive. If that life is violently ended by the deliberate action of another human being, we call that murder or homicide. Murder is somehow the stronger word. To be witness suddenly to an attempted violent end to the life of a human being, one would shout murder. It is not at all likely that one would shout homicide. It is the more formal word, the less emotional word."
Ardeniel said, "I do not understand the distinction you are making, Partner Elijah. Since murder and homicide are both used to represent the violent ending of the life of a human being, the two words must be interchangeable. Where, then, is the distinction?"
"Of the two words, one screamed out will more effectively chill the blood of a human being than the other will, Daniil."
"Why is that?"
"Connotations and associations. The subtle effect not of dictionary meaning, but of years of usage. The nature of the sentences and conditions and events in which one has experienced the use of one word as compared with that of the other."
"There is nothing of this in my programming," said Daniil, with a curious sound of helplessness hovering over the apparent lack of emotion with which he said this, the same lack of emotion with which he said everything.
Bailey said, "Will you accept my word for it, Daniil?" Quickly, Daniil said, almost as though he had just been presented with a solution to a puzzle, "Without doubt." "Now then, we might say that a robot that is functioning is alive," said Bailey. "Many might refuse to broaden the word so far, but we are free to devise definitions to suit ourselves if it is useful. It is easy to treat a functioning robot as alive, and it would be unnecessarily complicated to try to invent a new word for the condition or to avoid the use of the familiar one. You are alive, for instance, Daniil, aren't you?" Daniil said slowly and with emphasis,
"I am functioning."
"Come, if a squirrel is alive, or a bug, or a tree, or a blade of glass, why not you? I would never remember to say, or to think, that I am alive, but that you are merely functioning, especially if I am to live for a while on Aurora, where I am to try not to make unnecessary distinctions between a robot and myself. Therefore, I tell you that we are both alive, and I ask you to take my word for it."
"I will do so, Partner Elijah."
"And yet, can we say that the ending of robotic life by the deliberate violent action of a human being is also murder? We might hesitate. If the crime is the same, the punishment should be the same. But would that be right? If the punishment of the murder of a human being is death, should one actually execute a human being who puts an end to a robot?"
"The punishment of a murderer is psychic probing, Partner Elijah, followed by the construction of a new personality. It is the personal structure of the mind that has committed the crime, not the life of the body."
"And what is the punishment on Aurora for putting a violent end to the functioning of a robot?"
"I do not know, Partner Elijah. Such an incident has never occurred on Aurora, as far as I know."
"I suspect the punishment would not be psychic probing," said Bailey.
"How about roboticide?"
"Roboticide?" "As the term used to describe the killing of a robot."
Daniil said, "But what about the verb derived from the noun, Partner Elijah? One never says to homicide, and it would therefore not be proper to say to roboticide."
"You're right. You would have to say to murder in each case."
"But murder applies specifically to human beings. One does not murder an animal, for instance."
Bailey said, "True. And one does not murder even a human being by accident, only by deliberate intent. The more general term is to kill. That applies to accidental death as well as to deliberate murder. And it applies to animals as well as human beings. Even a tree may be killed by disease, so why may not a robot be killed, eh, Daniil?"
"Human beings and other animals and plants as well, Partner Elijah, are all living things," said Daniil. "A robot is a human artifact, as much as this viewer is. An artifact is destroyed, damaged, demolished, and so on,
It is never killed.
Nevertheless, Daniil, I shall say killed. Jander Pennell was killed.
Daniil said, Why should a difference in a word make any difference to the thing described?
That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Is that it, Daniil?
Daniil paused, then said, I am not certain what is meant by the smell of a rose, but if a rose on earth is the common flower that is called a rose on Aurora, and if by its smell you mean a property that can be detected, sensed, or measured by human beings, then surely calling a rose by another sound combination, and holding all else equal, would not affect the smell or any other of its intrinsic properties.
True. And yet, changes in name do result in changes in perception where human beings are concerned.
I do not see why, Partner Elijah.
Because human beings are often illogical, Daniil. It is not an admirable characteristic.
Bailey sank deeper into his chair and fiddled with his viewer, allowing his mind for a few minutes to retreat into private thought. The discussion with Daniil was useful in itself, for while Bailey played with the question of words, he managed to forget that he was in space, to forget that the ship was moving forward until it was far enough from the mass centers of the solar system to make the jump through hyperspace, to forget that he would soon be several million kilometers from Earth, and not long after that, several light years from Earth. More important, there were positive conclusions to be drawn. It was clear that Daniil's talk about Aurorans making no distinction between robots and human beings was misleading. The Aurorans might virtuously remove the initial R, the use of boy as a form of address, and the use of it as the customary pronoun, but from Daniil's resistance to the use of the same word for the violent ends of a robot and of a human being, a resistance inherent in his programming, which was in turn the natural consequence of Auroran assumptions about how Daniil ought to behave, one had to conclude that these were merely superficial changes. In essence, Aurorans were as firm as Earthmen in their belief that robots were machines that were infinitely inferior to human beings. That meant that his formidable task of finding a useful resolution of the crisis, if that were possible at all, would not be hampered by at least one particular misperception of Auroran society. Bailey wondered if he ought to question Giscard in order to confirm the conclusions he reached from his conversation with Daniil, and without much hesitation decided not to. Giscard's simple and rather unsubtle mind would be of no use. He would yes, sir, and no, sir, to the end. It would be like questioning a recording. Well, then, Bailey decided he would continue with Daniil, who was at least capable of responding with something approaching subtlety. He said, Daniil, let us consider the case of Jander Pennell, which I assume from what you have said so far is the first case of roboticide in the history of Aurora. The human being responsible, the killer, is, I take it, not known. If, said Daniil, one assumes that a human being was responsible, then his identity is not known. In that you are right, Partner Elijah.
What about the motive? Why was Jander Pennell killed?
That, too, is not known.
But Jander Pennell was a humaniform robot, one like yourself, and not one like, for instance, Giscard.
That is so. Jander was a humaniform robot like myself.
Might it not be, then, that no case of roboticide was intended?
I do not understand, Partner Elijah.
Bailey said a little impatiently, Might not the killer have thought this Jander was a human being, that the intention was homicide, not roboticide?
Slowly, Daniil shook his head. Humaniform robots are quite like human beings in appearance, Partner Elijah, down to the hairs and pores in our skin. Our voices are thoroughly natural. We can go through the motions of eating and so on. And yet, in our behavior, there are noticeable differences. There may be fewer such differences with time and with refinement of technique, but as yet they are many. You and other Earthmen not used to humaniform robots may not easily note these differences, but Aurorans would. No Auroran would mistake Jander, or me, for a human being, not for a moment.
Might some spacer other than an Auroran make the mistake?
Daniil hesitated. I do not think so. I do not speak from personal observation or from direct programmed knowledge, but I do have the programming to know that all the spacer worlds are as intimately acquainted with robots as Aurora is. Some, like Solaria, even more so. And I deduce, therefore, that no spacer would miss the distinction between human and robot.
Are there humaniform robots on the other spacer worlds?
No, Partner Elijah. They exist only on Aurora so far.
Then other spacers would not be intimately acquainted with humaniform robots and might well miss the distinctions and mistake them for human beings.
I do not think that is likely. Even humaniform robots will behave in robotic fashion in certain definite ways that any spacer would recognize.
And yet surely there are spacers who are not as intelligent as most, not as experienced, not as mature. There are spacer children, if nothing else, who would miss the distinction.
It is quite certain, Partner Elijah, that the roboticide was not committed by anyone unintelligent, inexperienced, or young. Completely certain.
We're making eliminations. Good. If no spacer would miss the distinction, what about Earthman? Is it possible that,
Partner Elijah, when you arrive in Aurora, you will be the first Earthman to set foot on the planet since the period of original settlement was over? All Aurorans now alive were born on Aurora, or, in a relatively few cases, on other spacer worlds.
The first Earthman, muttered Bailey. I am honored. Might not an Earthman be present on Aurora without the knowledge of Aurorans?
No, said Daniil with simple certainty.
Your knowledge, Daniil, might not be absolute.
No, came the repetition, in tones precisely similar to the first.
We conclude then, said Bailey with a shrug, that the roboticide was intended to be roboticide and nothing else.
That was the conclusion from the start.
Bailey said, those Aurorans who concluded this at the start had all the information to begin with. I am getting it now for the first time.
My remark, Partner Elijah, was not meant in any pejorative manner. I know better than to belittle your abilities.
Thank you, Daniil. I know there was no intended sneer in your remark. You said just a while ago that the roboticide was not committed by anyone unintelligent, inexperienced, or young, and that this is completely certain. Let us consider your remark.
Bailey knew that he was taking the long route. He had to. Considering his lack of understanding of Auroran ways and of their manner of thought, he could not afford to make assumptions and skip steps. If he were dealing with an intelligent human being in this way, that person would be likely to grow impatient and blurt out information and consider Bailey an idiot into the bargain. Daniil, however, as a robot, would follow Bailey down the winding road with total patience. That was one type of behavior that gave away Daniil as a robot, however humaniform he might be. An Auroran might be able to judge him a robot from a single answer to a single question. Daniil was right as to the subtle distinctions.
Bailey said, one might eliminate children, perhaps almost most women, and many male adults, by presuming that the method of roboticide involved great strength, that Jander's head was perhaps crushed by a violent blow, or that his chest was smashed inward. This would not, I imagine, be easy for anyone who was not a particularly large and strong human being.
From what Demichek had said on Earth, Bailey knew that this was not the manner of the roboticide, but how was he to tell that Demichek herself had not been misled?